podcast called again?
Today we're going to be talking about PTSD and trauma and stressor related disorders such as PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. So what's everyone's experience with PTSD? Listening to our last podcast was traumatizing at times, because it was a bit of a snoozer. So I'm sort of suffering from that and having flashbacks. And I certainly hope that we can be more lively, engaging, and informative this time around. Any other lived or clinical experiences with PTSD that will help form a case vignette for today's podcast?
Well, I've actually had PTSD in the past, for real, when I was a child. I think just above the diagnostic criteria cutoff age, around 6 years old, when I was viciously attacked by a loose attack dog in a third world country that I used to live in. And I had pretty much all of the symptoms. I especially remember the nightmares, just these insane, vague nightmares of being attacked by random animals, like snakes, you know, sitting on the bus and there's a snake chasing you on the side of the road. It really jumbled me up.
So that's horrible, dude. Do you still wet the bed? are you over your PTSD symptoms at this moment?
I still have nocturnal emissions, but I would say no symptoms. I think it resolved fairly quickly. Maybe that's why I'm such a resilient individual. I think after about, I think it was the span of months that it resolved. But I remember for a few years being, maybe having some hypersensitivity around vicious dogs. Like barking dogs, beware of dogs, signs with a dog beside it. A little bit of avoidance. I think lifetime prevalence of PTSD is about 6 to 9%. So it's really not that uncommon. And I saw that US Vietnam vets had about 30% prevalence of PTSD as well. So, you know, think about your emergency service personnel as well. So people like firefighters, police officers, paramedics, those that have a higher likelihood of seeing something gruesome. And it's also more frequent in women, I think 2-to-1 ratio, and especially in the mid to late 20s.
So that's interesting. More frequent in women.
Yeah.
Is that often related to like sexual assault, or is there? Because I thought there might be a male preponderance.
Yeah, or intimate partner violence, like.
I would say that it probably is most likely associated with sexual violence, because about a third of the instigating event of PTSD is a result of sexual violence, so things like rape or sexual childhood sexual abuse. The other third is traumatic experiences, like on behalf of someone else, someone close to the individual, like the unexpected death of a loved one. And to meet criteria, which we will go over in a sec, but usually it's in a spectacular, like horrifying way that the death of the loved one would happen in order to qualify for PTSD. It could also be the death of a child, or like a GF, like a GF is in a car accident, and then that feel with no GF. Interpersonal violence, 12%, so physical assault, threats of violence, things like that. So organized violence is another factor, about 10%. Organized violence is a bit of a vague term, but mostly related to war, like gang warfare potentially. Another 12% is life-threatening traumatic events. So car accident is the first thing that comes to mind. Natural disasters, chemical exposures.
Mm. Well, sometimes when I have to listen to Dr. P drone on, I get sort of this thousand-mile stare, feel it, like smell napalm, and feel like I'm back in Nam. Would that qualify as PTSD?
Well, it depends on how traumatic the instigating factor was. That's the thing with PTSD is it's one of the few diagnoses that's really based on that external factor.
Yeah, so I guess here it would depend how long were you listening to be rambling. And then if it was like hours, then yeah, maybe it would qualify.
Okay, so I'm gonna take that as a yes. Okay, so I too have suffered from PTSD. I salute you, Dr. I. We're comrades in arms here. Okay, well that was useful in terms of some criteria and epidemiology. Any other maybe more clinical, let's say, signs and symptoms associated with this diagnosis?
Right. I think it would be most useful to probably go through the DSM criteria.
Yeah.
You know, we'll go with the DSM because that's most likely what's going to be on the exam. You know, you can look at ICD and, you know, things like chronic PTSD, but we won't get into that. So, you know, let's just jump into it. DSM criteria. There's five, I believe, that you should, that involve lists of kind of what the symptoms and the exposure was. It's made up of the exposure to an actual or threat of death, serious injury, or sexual violence, the intrusion symptoms, avoidance behavior, negative cognition and mood, as well as changes in arousal. So jumping into it, criterion A. Exposure to
just pausing for a moment there. So when you're having a video chat with Dr. P, and he becomes sort of sexually threatening, but you find it arousing, would that meet DSM criteria?
So there's a lot of subjectivity as to what like a threat is. You know, people have different thresholds of what's going to be traumatic. And the PTSD guidelines try to bring at least some element of objectivity to this, because some people are just so unhinged to begin with that failing a math test at school is going to make them dysregulate. So it has to be a direct experience of traumatic events based on the DSM criteria, witnessing this event occurring to others, or learning that this traumatic event occurred to a close family member. And again, it has to be violent or accidental in nature, or it's through the repeated exposure of this event. So, you know, people that like FBI agents that sit through child porn all day, 911 responders or first responders, that repeatedly see gruesome things, they would qualify. However, exposure through electronic media, you know, scary movies, seeing a scary picture online, that's not enough to qualify for PTSD.
Right.
So Dr. P's, you know, chatterbait situation last week where, you know, he pulled out his D&B on cam. That's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you have to see Dr. P's P in person for it to be used. Just in Dr. P's P online is not enough.
Yeah, and it's threateningly small. Like, that's what is so traumatic about it. It really gets down to your core, to your soul.
Yeah. Well, it's that combined with the rigidity, I think, is the...
It's like a needle. Okay, fair play. Yeah, so that's understood.
Now, Dr. T, can you tell us about some intrusion symptoms that somebody with PTSD might be experiencing?
Absolutely, I'd love to.
So in terms of some intrusive symptoms, some folks may experience recurrent involuntary intrusive distressing memories. And when we talk about intrusive, it's, for example, like functionally limiting. So you're sitting at work and you can't help but having sort of these flashbacks of that IED exploding or the micropenis. Some folks may have recurrent dreams, as Dr. I experienced, where the content or affect are related to the dramatic event. The nightmares should be related to that traumatic event. The physical reactions, like again, intrusive symptoms, feeling just acutely anxious, panicked by any cues that could resemble the traumatic event. So thus the advent of trigger warnings, for example. I think that was a useful list of some important intrusive symptoms.
So criterion C, this is going to be avoidance. This is the persistent avoidance of stimuli that one would associate with a traumatic event. You'll be trying to avoid distressing things that would bring up those memories again or feelings associated with that event again. Or the individual will try to avoid external reminders. So they might avoid certain people or places or objects that can bring about these memories. Criterion D, so this is going to be negative alterations in cognition and mood. So there is going to be a mood component with this PTSD, and you'll need two of the following criteria. The first is the inability to remember the event. You have to make sure that this isn't due to a like medical factor or drugs. The second one is persistent and exaggerated negative beliefs or expectations about oneself. So people will often feel like they are damaged goods or the world is entirely dangerous. I can't trust anyone. I'm a horrible person. Why did I do this to myself? Like those kinds of thoughts. Persistent distorted cognitions. So especially about the cause or the consequences of the event. So again, people will try to blame themselves or others when, you know, maybe it was an accident, maybe there's nobody particularly to blame, but people can ruminate on those thoughts. A persistent negative emotional state, so feeling depressed, sad, angry, guilty, scared. Anhedonia, so marked diminished interest in your activities. So this is bringing in the functional element of PTSD. Feelings of detachment or estrangement from others. No one understands me, you know, and persistent inability to experience positive emotions. You just can't find the joy that you once did. Criterion E,
right.
Anybody want to jump into that one?
Criterion E. I don't have the DSM.
All right. I'll just finish up.
Sorry about that.
No worries.
Yeah, sorry about that.
So criterion E is changes in arousal. So this is going to be alterations in arousal and reactivity associated with this event. So things like irritability and outbursts of anger. Anger is a bit of a complicated topic, but I find that oftentimes when people are overwhelmed or don't know how to feel, that they might lash out, and that's how the anger comes about. But that's neither here nor there. The second one is reckless or self-destructive behavior. Third is hypervigilance. Fourth is an exaggerated startle response. Fifth is problems with concentration. And sixth is sleep disturbance.
Right.
So, A, B, C, D, E. With the exposure, you need at least one of the criteria. With the intrusion symptoms, again, just one. avoidance, just one of the two. With the negative cognition or mood, it needs to be at least two, but they're quite, they're lower threshold. And same with the changes in cognition and arousal, you need two as well. And very critical for your exams, this is these criterion. Aside from the exposure element, they have to persist for 1 month. So the actual event could have happened a long time ago, but we want to make sure that these symptoms are persisting for 1 month before we give the diagnosis.
Right.
As with every other DSM criteria, we have criterion G, which indicates that this disturbance results in significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. Very important. Like, they're not able to necessarily do all the things that they used to do, go out with people, or attend to their job. And again, criterion H, this disturbance is not attributable to a substance or medication or another medical condition, in which case we would be looking at the rest of our differential. Obviously, this list is very long. It can be tough to remember. So I'll just throw in a mnemonic here for PTSD, just the general criteria. The mnemonic is trauma. So T stands for traumatic event. R is for re-experiencing, the intrusive thoughts, right? Avoidance for A, and unable to function for U. M is 1 month, at least, of the symptoms, and A is the arousal increase.
Good, excellent. Yeah, and I think that was really helpful too, like going through a DSM diagnosis, where, you know, we may going through a DSM diagnosis to point out that it is a little long-winded or whatever. It seems almost a little bit pedantic, but with the understanding that in psychiatry, these thresholds have to be met, right? If we're going to be defining clinical entities, there has to be criteria laid out. So, some people may have traits of a particular diagnosis, but being clear that DSM is consensus based, and hopefully there's lots of expertise that's brought to it. And if criteria are less than rigorous and less than clearly laid out, then there will be, you know, potentially overdiagnosis or overlap of diagnosis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm sort of being an apologist for DSM, which is often criticized for the length and involvement of the criteria. But I think that in this case, it was quite useful to really just lay it out how sort of rigorous DSM diagnosing really can be. Practically speaking, for things like depression and anxiety, do we do that all the time? Probably not. Use DSM criteria, but for these more unique therapeutically distinguished entities such as PTSD, really diving into those details, I think, is helpful.
That's true. I think it would be useful to go through the differential diagnoses for PTSD to really bring home why it's they're being so pedantic. is that something you guys are interested in today?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, Dr. P, I think you're muted there, but what do you think? What else could we be thinking about? Somebody experiences a traumatic event. You're seeing a patient for the first time. Is there anything else you can think of that might be resulting in their distress? You don't necessarily have to tell us about like the differentiating factors, but what else could it be?
You mean apart from PTSD?
Yeah.
I mean, they could be on drugs or something.
Yeah, exactly. So we can rule that out with one of the criterion of PTSD, the criterion G. It can't be due to a substance.
Yeah.
Although that is a great point, you know, I'll take the opportunity to say that PTSD has a lot of comorbidities. And I would say close to one half, from what I've read, about a half of individuals that are seeking treatment for substance use disorder, so people with alcohol, you know, alcoholics, all the fentanyl addicts and the cannabis addicts out there, those degenerate cannabis addicts, about half of them will meet criteria for PTSD then. So not past PTSD, not history of PTSD, but PTSD symptoms then. And usually when people do have comorbidities, the outcomes don't look as good because they do need multifactorial treatment. And especially in men, a substance use disorder in men, you will find that oftentimes there is ongoing PTSD. So so substances, that's one thing on the differential. What else can we think of?
I like adjustment disorder as a within criteria. So basically, you know, will not meet criteria for things like bereavement or PTSD. And it's usually more temporally closer to the traumatic event. It's actually very brief, even DSM criteria. So within 3 months of the stressor, symptoms are characterized by marked distress that's out of proportion to the severity of the stressor, with functional impairment. So for example, bereavement is considered an appropriate, normal response to the loss of a loved one. Whereas adjustment disorder might be, for example, someone, you know, loses their job and then shit goes entirely off the rails. So that is a useful, commonly used diagnosis, particularly in general practice. And there's often some qualifiers. I should point out that once the stressor or the consequences of the stressor are removed, such as the person regains employment, symptoms tend not to persist for more than 6 months. And there's specifiers like with depressed mood, with anxiety, with conduct disturbance, but you see adjustment disorder all of the time. So basically inappropriate negative response to a stressor within 3 months that resolves within 6 months after stressor is removed.
Yeah, and I think one of the benefits of adjustment disorder is that the stressor can be of any severity. So somebody may be as distressed as somebody with PTSD, but it's a bit more of a catch-all diagnosis because ultimately the traumatic event is going to be subjectively traumatic. You know, not everybody is triggered by the same thing. What about if somebody is meeting the criterion for PTSD, but it's been less than a month? What would we be considering then?
Yeah, because one of the DSM qualifiers for PTSD is not like in clinically significant distress.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know what is that? How do you define that? Yeah, what's that called? Acute stress disorder.
Hell yeah, man! It's acute stress disorder. So yeah, it's acute stress disorder. The symptoms have to be between 3 days and a month after the traumatic event. You know, after a month, it's most likely PTSD or consider adjustment. And then the first 3 days, you know, that's just human life, man. That's just normal human reaction. You know, if somebody gets, somebody close to you gets shot, then I think it would be completely reasonable to be distressed about it a couple days later, you know? So don't pathologize normal human behavior. Always have that at the back of your mind.
What if I was microaggressed without a trigger warning? Yeah. And it's been over a month. Is that PTSD?
Yeah, it's a micro stress disorder.
Yeah, micro adjustment disorder.
Yeah,
right.
Sorry, micro penis adjustment disorder. Anyhow, proceed.
Yeah, my GF has that. She's still adjusting and traumatized and avoiding it daily, unfortunately.
Yeah, at my age, I'm still adjusting.
It's been years. It's been about 13 years.
It's been 30 years. I still haven't adjusted.
Of intensive therapy. Intensive exposure therapy.
Yeah.
My therapist suggests
they've been blasting me with testosterone since I was one, but to no avail.
So let's say you get a question that says that the event occurred, but quite a few of the symptoms were actually occurring before the traumatic event. I mean, there was certainly an exacerbation after the traumatic event, but what would you be thinking about at that point?
So I don't know. I don't know. Would it be a PTSD with a qualifier?
No. I think that was kind of a read my mind question. I was thinking more along the lines of personality disorders.
I see.
Yeah. So, this is going to take a much more detailed psychiatric history to really elicit this out. And they might be comorbid as well. But I would say that generally, if somebody has a pattern of maladaptive coping skills or maladaptive coping mechanisms or some symptoms that may not necessarily match with the PTSD criteria, but certainly have resulted in impaired function, consider personality disorders. I would say another thing you might be looking at clinically, practically, is if there are a lot of focus on interpersonal difficulties after a traumatic event. Then consider personality disorders then.
Right. Intriguing. Yeah, it's very interesting. And so moving on, I guess, so we had a very excellent definitions, excellent differential. Well, now, so what? I mean, how are we going to help these people?
Dr. P, any guess as to what you feel might be?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking probably a combination of trauma therapy as well as biological or pharmaceutical aids. So on the pharmaceutical side, we'd be looking at probably SSRIs like fluoxetine, paroxetine, sertraline. And then on the treatment side, or on the therapy side, something like cognitive behavioral therapy is probably helpful.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's up to the discretion of the practitioner which way to go. And of course, patient autonomy, all that, up to the patient as well. What they feel most positively about is something that you should probably try to chase down. Whatever intervention people feel optimistic about, I feel will probably respond better. So certainly, our SSRIs, SNRIs, there's certainly evidence for this. In terms of CBT, it is one of the first line treatments. There is a form of CBT that is trauma focused that's called cognitive processing therapy, or CPT, or TFCBT. Depending on the type of exposure, you can consider exposure therapy as well. If somebody is if the avoidance criterion are especially problematic and affecting function, then you can consider that. EMDR, that's, I don't know much about the evidence for this, but this is eye movement desensitization reprocessing therapy. I think the the Veterans Affairs in the States, they really push this one quite a bit, but I don't know how effective it is.
I don't know about the specific modalities, and fortunately, I think for testing purposes, you know, hopefully those details won't come up.
Yeah.
But clearly, if you have a psychiatry focus, that will be relevant. And being aware, like just generally speaking, that there are targeted therapies. So, you know, CBT is not a, a cure-all, is not the universal answer. Yeah.
And, you know, you can target specific symptoms as well. So you can consider for like a short course benzos, although obviously there's a huge dependence risk with that. So at your own discretion. And for the nightmares in particular, you know, some people are really, really, really distressed by nightmares. It can impair sleep, like the it can result in an initial insomnia, early wakening. Some people are just scared to go to bed, and then when you're not sleeping, that's just gonna just crush your mood. It's just gonna destroy you as an individual. So I have a pretty low threshold for treating nightmares, and the medication for that is prazosin. You know, I don't know how you feel about a Dr. T. It works better for some people than others, but I find it's worth giving it a try.
Yeah, I mean, especially at night, and if they're not hypotensive, it's a very benign medication. So if it's helpful, it's helpful.
Yeah.
So in the class of alpha blockers, and therefore can decrease blood pressure a little bit, huge dosing range, which is important as well. But I would say you see it quite frequently. And I think trazodone is used in that setting as well, and has some evidence helping with nightmares. But I would agree. I think prazosin is used first line.
All right. Any more thoughts on PTSD here?
No. I think that's a good summary both. I think it was actually really useful to go over the DSM criteria in detail. And forgive me if I missed it, but for testing purposes, there are two relevant questionnaires. Did you guys mention the CAPS questionnaire?
No, but that's a good idea to go over that.
Yeah. So there's, I'll make two quick points that are relevant to primary care. So one is a questionnaire. It's called the clinically administered PTSD scale, and it's used in a lot of research studies as well. And that's the CAPS questionnaire. So it's actually used to follow PTSD symptoms in response to therapies. And it's something that you can administer in your clinic. And there's something called the Top 8 as well, which is a shorter version. As always, so that's important for testing purposes. That can come up. Again, that's the CAPS questionnaire. And then in terms of two screening questions that you can so this has a 95% sensitivity and an 80% specificity. So it's quite useful for ruling out PTSD. Have you experienced or seen a life-threatening or traumatic event such as rape, accident, someone badly hurt or killed, assault, natural or man-made disaster, war, or torture? And do you re-experience the event in a disturbing way, such as through dreams, intrusive memories, flashbacks, or physical reactions to situations that remind you of the event? And I like that we actually save that to the end, because it's sort of a useful summary in contrast to DSM criteria, which is if they answer yes to both of those questions, you're really thinking about the possibility of PTSD. Okay. I think that was great. Yeah. So interesting topic, and you'll see it not infrequently. And now you're equipped with some tools to start helping these folks. In fact, I'm going to have to take my prazosin soon, or else I'm going to end up seeing Dr. P's micropenis again in my dreams. So,
yeah, if this podcast goes on any longer, I'm going to get acute stress.
All right, boys, sleep tight.